Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded November 15th, 2010, episode 42, DIY Geek Fest. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. My guest geek this week is Nelson Pass, founder of Pass Labs and DIY guru. Hey, Nelson, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much.
My pleasure. I'm really glad to have you on. I've known your name for many, many years, and so it's a great pleasure to speak with you, and hopefully we will get some questions from the chat room. As always, I invite those of you who are tuned into the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv to post questions for Nelson, and I will pass on along as many as I can. So Nelson, let's start with how you got started in amp and speaker design.
Well, it was a classic case of teenager who has a mother who owned hi-fi and listened to a lot of music, and I grew up that way.
Now, and your mother was the hi-fi geek in your house, not your father?
Well, yeah, actually. I mean, he involved himself in acquiring the equipment, but she was the one who did most of the listening. And so there was a fine record collection, and I spent a lot of time with it. About the time that I was 16 or so, I pretty much had the bug, and I needed my own equipment. But I didn't have any money, so I started cobbling things together out of pieces and such. And by the time I hit college, I found myself hanging out with people who were far more sophisticated in these matters, and some of them were designing gear. And well, that's what happens when you hang out with people like that. You get involved in stuff, and there it was. It just took off from there and ultimately became a career.
Yes. Now, I believe in your bio it talks about designing or working on DIY projects while you were in college, and also while you were working at ESS, which was a speaker company in the 70s, I believe.
Well, as I say, I fell in with a crowd of people who were doing this already. Specifically, there was a guy named Peter Werbeck who was designing his own amplifiers, and he had a roommate who was a friend of mine. He got a job at ESS, which at that time was a startup, and he was designing amplifiers for them. And I ended up in 1972 getting a job there also, only I didn't design amplifiers. I designed crossovers, built prototypes for speakers, and in general R&D. I arrived a week before Oscar Heil did, so I got to see all the excitement from the ground floor.
Wow, the Heil Motion Transformer, I believe it's called, was a revolution in tweeter design, wasn't it?
I think so, yes.
And as I recall, that was based on a ribbon-type transducer technology?
Well, it was a ribbon kind of arrangement, but what it was a folded ribbon that worked in such a way as to gain more leverage over the acoustic characteristic of air. It's one thing to push air with a flat diaphragm because you have a situation where the air is going to, for all intents and purposes, move at the same velocity as the diaphragm. If you fold the ribbon and make it operate a little bit more like an accordion so as to squeeze air, you can make the air travel faster than the motion of the diaphragm itself. You can impart a lot more energy to the air, and it it not only makes it a lot more efficient, but it makes it a little faster too within certain limits. The upshot being is that it was definitely an advance in tweeter design, and of course it made Meaty assess very successful, put them on the map, and consequently gave me a lot of experience in the industry and how things go. And I was there for a year and a half designing speakers, crossovers, and so on for Heil Air Motion Transformers.
Is that transformer, the Heil Air Motion Transformer, still being used at all by anyone today?
You can still buy them new, as a matter of fact.
Is ESS still in business? I didn't realize that.
ESS is apparently still in business. They are, right now they're located in Southern California, if I'm not mistaken. So that production had gone off to Europe for a period of time. But earlier this year, I got a call from the people in Southern California saying, here we are, we're back in the U.S., we're making speakers, and there it is.
What do you know? Now, after ESS, I believe you went on to co-found a company called Threshold.
Well, I was at ESS for nearly 2 years, and during that time, as I say, I was designing speaker stuff, but at the same time, I had gotten the bug for building my own amplifiers. And a person who's associated with ESS, Renee Besnay, who is actually their marketing director and was in charge of advertising, artwork, a lot of industrial design, and so on, he and I were close friends, and we decided that it was one of those, if these guys can do it, I guess anybody can. So we launched Threshold in 1975, and spent about a year developing the first product, and subsequently launched what became the 800A, which was the first version of an amplifier that used dynamic bias to get a little higher efficiency out of a Class A amplifier.
Now, was that a tube-based amp or a solid-state?
That was solid-state.
Mm-hmm. Is Class A often implemented with solid state? I've more often heard about that being used with tube-based amps.
Well, Class A is functional with either type of device, and it just simply is the least efficient way that you can amplify audio, but it's also the most linear way, and so people have to often make a choice. Are you going to have something that is either low power, or are you going to put up with something that puts out a tremendous amount of heat in comparison to the energy that it's going to put at a loudspeaker? Typical efficiencies of a Class A amplifier are down around 30% or so, sometimes less, sometimes a little more. The more conventional Class AB type amplifiers that you play with are, you know, in excess of 50%, and of course Class D is getting up into the 80 to 90% region. Mm-hmm. So you pay a penalty for Class A. It's the one in which the output transistors are always conducting in the linear region. This is also true of tubes or I guess there are no other gain devices. But the
tubes are transistors, yes.
Transistors, pretty much it.
And as I recall, Class A basically uses one set of amplifying devices, be they tubes or transistors, to amplify the entire waveform, both as it swings into the positive region and as it swings into the negative region. Compared with Class B or Class AB, with some variation there, where one set of devices amplifies the positive swings and another set of devices amplifies the negative swings. Have I got that right?
That's pretty much it. There's also single-ended Class A, in which you have essentially one amplifying device, which is necessarily going to be Class A because there's no opportunity to operate in what's thought of as push-pull. In push-pull, you've got a positive half to an output stage and a negative half, and it's kind of a relay race where one half of it does work in the positive region for a while, and then it's time to switch off to the negative half. And if you envision it as a relay race, what you've got is the sound, the signal, it could be thought of as the baton, and they have to share that baton. Somebody does a lap, hands over the baton. The key for performance when you're doing that sort of thing is a question of how well the baton is transferred. If you look at a real relay race, what you've got is the person who's going to get the baton begins running before the handoff. And so there is a period of time where both halves, both runners, as it were, are working and sharing the signal and the load. And that results in a very smooth transition. And you can imagine, by contrast, a situation where the runner simply stops dead, hands over the baton, and then the other guy begins running. That's known as Class B. And there's a reason why Class B isn't very popular, is because of that discontinuity.
So Class AB is when both runners are running for a little while as the baton is passed.
Right. In Class A, both runners are holding the baton all the time. And it works very well, but it's very inefficient.
I've got a question from the chat room here asking if you've heard of Class T digital amplifiers and what you think of them.
Class T is perhaps the TriPath digital amplifiers. I don't know if that's the specific reference. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, I believe, if that's the case, we're dealing with a Class D variation, which is where the T is actually probably a trade name for the product and for the particular design.
Can you describe briefly what a Class D amp is? Many people call this a digital amp, and I know that that's sometimes a misnomer.
It is, in fact, inaccurate. A Class D amplifier is a switching amplifier. It's technically an analog device, or even thought of as a linear device, although it's the most nonlinear way of pretending to accomplish this. In that, you have almost like a Class B amplifier, two halves, one positive, one negative. One is on, and then the other is on, but they switch back and forth very, very fast, and the signal output is actually reflects the duration with which one side, the top half or the bottom half, is on versus the duration of the other side. So if the if the positive side of the Class D output stage is on longer than the negative side, then you have a net positive. And it's switched at such a fast rate that you can filter those frequencies out that are the actual sampling rate. And what's left over is a low frequency that we would refer to as the audio.
Okay. I'm getting a bunch of questions from the chat room, which I really appreciate. F-Loop asks, are integrated audio components from semiconductor manufacturers getting good enough for you? You keep assessing new integrated products for manufacturers, or have you given up on them?
Well, good enough is
the relative
context,
term.
On the context, yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem with any of these things. Since the course of the 60s and 70s, as technology has progressed, the overall average quality of equipment has gotten considerably better. It's a little bit like the California wine industry. If you go back to the 50s, the types of wine that you could get in California and the variations in quality were not exceedingly good, and European wine would be what you'd want to normally be drinking. But the California wine industry invested a lot of money in the technology. I went to UC Davis, which is where I got a lot of this. And they invested a lot at UC Davis, and science came in, as it were, and raised the average level through technology of everything that you could make. And so when you go to the store now, you can buy a large variety of wines and different levels of quality and cost, but they're all pretty good. They're all pretty drinkable. Audio is kind of along the same way. There is a, on average, a tremendous improvement in the quality of at least the electronic reproduction. And but there is still quite a bit of variety in terms of the, high-end offerings. And the other thing is that everybody has different needs. We are looking at people who are listening in their car. We're talking about people about who are, hiking or treadmilling or
listening on some of the MP3 players and so on.
Well, yeah, and the real point here is that there's a wide range of equipment that meets different people's needs, and they all have very different needs.
Yes, indeed. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I wanted to talk quite a bit today, actually, about DIY and your advocacy of do-it-yourself projects. And I know that we have a photo of your very first DIY amp, which I guess it's the first one that you actually designed. As opposed to built from a kit or something. Here it is. Tell us a bit about this.
Well, that is the first amplifier that I designed from scratch and built. It is also my first effort at what's thought of as a non-switching amplifier. I mentioned the 800A a little while ago, which was the successor to this design. This is an amplifier that it was a pretty good amplifier for its day, but what was unique about it was the output stage pieces, the transistors in the output stage, the positive and negative halves, never actually shut off. And so that was an improvement over the ones which do.
Now, you call this a switching amp. Is it a Class D amplifier?
Well, when we're talking about push-pull amplifiers and the classes, in Class A, the output stage, the two halves never shut off whatsoever. But in a Class B or AB amplifier, when one of them is doing the work, the other one is actually shut off. And so the goal in this particular case was to keep them humming along without dissipating too much energy. And so you play some tricks with the curves so that the actual devices themselves are maintained in some sort of conducting state. There are specific delays associated with turn on and turn off for transistors. And so while this isn't particularly Class A, it's differentiated from what's been referred to as pure Class A, it nevertheless had an improvement in that the transistors were at least hopped up and always ready to go.
So they took less time to get running, to go back to the runner relay race analogy, it took less time for them to get up and going because they were always in a sense running.
Yeah, even if they weren't running very much, they were at least standing.
Jogging, shall we say?
Yeah, that would be another way of putting it.
Okay. Now, in addition to amplifiers, which you have done many of yourself, you also have been involved in DIY speaker projects. And I know we have a couple of pictures of those as well. The J-Lo, for example, which I imagine you probably named before Jennifer Lopez took on that name, right?
Well, the reason it was called a J-Lo was that it used a Jordan full-range driver, a little 4-inch full-range driver, as the source of bottom end through top end. And if you look at it, it looks like a little button on the front there. And so quite a small driver, as you can probably see. And the whole point of having big backloaded horns behind those drivers is to amplify the rear wave off of the little speaker and give it enough horn expansion and amplification in the bottom end so that they could do bottom end as well as mid-range and as well as top end. They already did a fine job in the mid and top. What they needed was some help to go loud in the bottom. And the horns do that. So they J comes from the Jordans, and of course the low comes from the enclosure that gave them some significant bottom end. Gotcha. And no, Jennifer Lopez was already around. That was a pun.
Now, a question in the chat room is something I actually was planning to ask. If we can put the picture back up, you will see on the top of the equipment rack that stands between these two speakers are two boxes with a bunch of light bulbs on top of them. What's going on with those?
Oh, well, those are the Zen lights. A little bit story is probably appropriate. One of the most popular series of DIY sets of projects that I've done is a series of amplifiers, and this is for DIY, called the Zen amplifiers. And they were and are an exploration into how simple you can make a good sounding amplifier. And of course, in the end, which a real goal for that would be, well, how good can we make it with only one transistor? And the Zen is once again a small joke. It comes from the koan, which is, what is the sound of one transistor clapping? So the Zen series, though, is very popular. And one of the reasons for that is that these projects were sufficiently simple that a lot of people who were otherwise intimidated by big schematics and complexity in projects looked at that and said, you know, I probably could do that. And the Zen light is a very simple circuit in which you can take a single transistor using no other semiconductors in the amplifier whatsoever. You do have to come up with a power supply, and that inevitably is going to mean probably a rectifier bridge. But taking that out of the equation, or imagining that you perhaps were driving this thing with batteries, which you could do, the Zen amplifier was a single MOSFET that was attached to light bulb. That, or in this case, some parallel light bulbs that act as the load and the bias circuit for that, and you had an amplifier. More recently, there's a project that I posted at DIYaudio.com called the D-Lite, which is a new type of depletion mode JFET transistor, but I went back and dragged out the light bulbs again. And the light bulbs are very convenient. You could use a resistor to do that job, but you have to buy an expensive resistor and stick it on a heat sink. Or you can go down to the hardware store and get a 300-watt light bulb and a socket for about, well, the socket will cost you less than a dollar. Plug it in and you're done. And of
so
course,
the light bulb is performing the same job as the resistor in this circuit.
It's being used as a resistor. It just happens that it gives you the benefit of glowing nicely and looks great at night.
That's amazing.
Well, but the great part was that these things are very doable. Anybody can go get a light bulb, and if you feel even most marginally competent with regards to handling that kind of stuff, you can build an amplifier, and that's really the cool thing about particularly audio DIY is that you can get in and play, and you can get satisfaction for initially for not a lot of effort, and so you tend to get hooked with it because it's doable.
Right. And you had four light bulbs on that. Oh, well, let me ask you this. I forgot. What was the power output of that? Of that Zen?
The initial version on that was, 7-8 watts. Not very much. The Jordan is a pretty efficient speaker, and you horn load it, and it's even more efficient. 4 or 5 watts was perfectly adequate to drive that system, which is another thing that's kind of interesting. DIY tends to bring this out also, and that is that loudspeakers, for the most part, are unnecessarily inefficient. In the old days, when you were running tubes, and tubes were expensive, and they also consumed a large amount of power and ran hot, a big amplifier was 30, 40 watts. Your really big amp was 70 watts. And a lot of loudspeakers were designed around that when you look in the 50s and 60s. And, of course, even before that, it was even worse. There was an age in which loudspeakers were particularly efficient, and amplifiers didn't have a tremendous amount of power. If you go back and listen to this stuff at this late date, it tends to be very good. I have some fine examples here. We at Pass Labs keep Altex, Tannoy's. I've got a nice new set of JBL L300s that I got recently. When you look at a lot of the speakers that are involved, that you run across in DIY stuff, some of them are extremely efficient. We're talking 95, maybe more than 100 dB on a watt. So most of the stuff I play with for DIY is drivable with 5 to 10 watts without any problems at all.
Now, a question in the chat room from X-Ranger says, back in the day, low-efficiency speakers were all the rage. Now, high-efficiency speakers are the norm. What are the trade-offs? Is he correct that low-efficiency speakers were the norm back in the day?
Well, I don't know how far you have to go back. If you go back far enough, high efficiency was really it, because you didn't have that much power to work with. Now, when you start looking at the advent of higher power amplifiers in the late 60s, when you could buy a Dynaco 60 watt per channel amplifier for not very much money, or a Harman Kardon Citation 12, again, about 60 watts. And then people like our friend Bob Carver, who you interviewed, came along and started offering 400 watts. ESS came out with an amplifier that was maybe 300 watts a channel. And new transistors, new hardware from the late 60s and early 70s made it possible to develop really high power without a tremendous amount of resources being spent. And so loudspeaker manufacturers found themselves with a wealth of power to work with. They had the power, and the consumer had the wattage. They began making trade-offs to use that power to their advantage, and so less efficient speakers became the norm after a matter of short number of years. And the advantage was, first off, the boxes were made smaller, and so it became the wife acceptance factor for hi-fi became a lot easier to achieve, because the things like the audio, the acoustic research AR3 and other designs which had relatively heavy woofers could get deep bottom end, or relatively deep bottom end, without a large enclosure. So suddenly bookshelf speakers were available that had some bass. And this also coincides with the advent of the popularity of rock and roll and the Beatles and everybody else. So people wanted that bass, and it all fell together. But in a very real sense, the industry kind of took a left turn. There is still very much a orientation of how many watts. I mean, most of the market still deals in terms of how many watts. If you're an auto sound, it absolutely is how many watts. The efficient speaker and low power amplifier crowd is a subset of the high end audio industry. And when I say high end audio, I'm thinking two channel home audio, as distinguished from car sound, as distinguished from pro sound, as distinguished from home theater sound.
Mm-hmm.
So the tweaks out there who are doing DIY, a lot of them really appreciate high efficiency speakers. They like the sound of that stuff, and it also, of course, is easier to build amplifiers of low power. In my case, I specialize in low power largely because, first off, they're charming amplifiers. You can do a lot of things with a simple amplifier if you're not constrained by having to make it extremely large and extremely powerful. And but if, in fact, it has a fairly easy job to do, you can concentrate on the sound of the amplifier itself instead of a lot of other issues. And, of course, it makes it a lot easier to build if you're a DIYer. But the other thing is that there is a sonic characteristic to high-efficiency drivers, horn drivers, some of the full-range drivers like the Lowthers and such. that are very appealing to a good segment of the audiophile population. And I personally find them very interesting. And as I say, I tend to work with them in the hobby sense.
Mm-hmm. Got a question from the chat room. How do you assess the impact of your DIY involvement on your commercial business? Does it take away from your business, or does it increase your cred among audiophiles?
Well, it does increase my cred among audiophiles. We get huge numbers of hits at our webpage, and a lot of that is associated with the DIY activities that we have. Mm-hmm. At DIYaudio.com, where I basically have my DIY nest for public consumption, we get a tremendous amount of traffic. There's a large number of people registered there. There's a large number of people who just go there without registering. And a good example is the DIY thread on the F5 amplifier, which is I'm sure you'll bring up First Watt, but is a product that First Watt, which is my little company, developed and published the plans in such a manner that people could build their own. That thread's at 1.5 million hits at this. No, I'm sorry, it's 1.3 million hits at this point. Mm-hmm. And we find that, you know, we have millions of hits at the websites with both First Watt and Pass Labs, and it's an enormous amount of traffic when you consider that. This is largely DIY. So there is it does put your name out there. There's a lot more recognition, name recognition as a result. Mm-hmm. And there's a considerable amount of goodwill. That's one positive thing about that. The other is, of course, is that we're doing good. We're contributing to something that I think is an important effort. It's an important effort on a lot of fronts. First off, is that it doesn't get as much support from the industry as it probably deserves, in considering that a lot of these people are people who frequented or dealt with retail establishments back when there was more support for two-channel, before they got involved in home theater and suddenly found that they weren't as interested in the hi-fi guy who used to come around. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has gone over to the net. The other thing about it is that, you know what kind of life we have at this point. People are expected to be more and more consumers than anything else, and things are structured so that it's tougher and tougher to be a part of the things in your daily life. You buy a television set, you don't have much of a chance to open it up and fool with it. People don't get to work on their cars the way they used to. Certainly, I wouldn't ever make such an effort, and so. And people's jobs similarly are, I don't know how to put it, you know, cubicleized in some way or other. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that, and people need some form of creative outlet, and we'll find it. And very often, DIY audio is just about ideal, because almost everybody loves music. And like I said, if they give it a shot, they'll probably get the bug.
Now, part of that last question was, do you reserve anything? Do you have any secret sauce in Pass Lab products, for example, that you wouldn't share with the public, with the DIY community, I should say?
Well, inevitably, it all gets shared. But there is such a thing as timing. And so very often, so this stuff bleeds out a bit at a time. Currently, at both Pass Labs and in First Watt, there are some trade secrets that are involved, which we keep to ourselves, because we do need to occasionally sell amplifiers, and we can't be giving it all away. but mostly it just comes down to lead time. The projects at First Watt, for example, were always set up as limited duration. And so while I put the information out there in general so that DIYers could begin thinking about it and many of them could begin developing the circuits on their own, in other words, leave enough breadcrumbs and hints and information that the brighter of them begin assembling these products for themselves anyways, which, by the way, is all to the good. The key thing that we have to avoid is simply putting ourselves in a position where people, manufacturers simply begin offering the products, or in the case of DIY, the boards and the kits, in such a manner that it kills the sales of commercial product. So we find that it's just simply the best way of dealing with that is to put some the time space between the introduction of commercial product and then releasing more technical details with regards to it later. Mm-hmm. At this time, I have a couple of products out at first watt, the M2 and the J2, which I've essentially published everything that everybody would actually need to know to put those together, and there are people building them. However, there is no official schematic, and I've discovered that the cloners usually wait until they can get a hold of an official schematic, one that's actually signed that says, "This is it, folks," before they will go and invest on their own to produce boards and try to get them sold and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a fine line. But that said, we aren't doing anything so wild or dramatic that, for instance, our actual commercial competition couldn't simply buy the amplifier and go, "Oh yeah, that's what they're doing." There's not much means for preventing that. But having said that, there's not much actual need. The competition all has their own designs and usually too busy bad-mouthing your stuff to copy it. So it's really not that. I don't find that to be a problem. The cloners are kind of an annoyance. But it's not nearly the problem that people imagine. Part of it is just showmanship, too. I mean, in the case of DIY stuff, if I just splat it all out right away, people don't get nearly as much entertainment out of it as they will if you time it out properly.
Right, right. Well, I've got several questions in the chat room about First Watt, and that was certainly something I wanted to spend a considerable amount of time on here. But before we do, I wanted to take a moment to thank my sponsor for this episode, Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use UI for creating and managing your website or blog. It's optimized for both beginners and experts, and there are hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of them to fit your needs. The all-inclusive service includes several modules to build your website, such as blog modules, a forum, form builder, Flickr photo display, something I would use, a Twitter widget, Google Maps, and more. There's website tracking and a built-in search engine optimizer, and permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability, an innovative drag-and-drop AJAX interface, even an iPhone app to manage and access your website from wherever you are. Use Squarespace for all your website needs. Build it, host it, update it anytime. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just try it out and build your own website. Then, if you decide to purchase, use the offer code HTG and get 10% off the lifetime of your new account. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. So, getting back to Nelson Pass, we've been covering a lot of DIY ground, and I've gotten several questions in the chat room about First Watt. And I wanted to ask first about the name First Watt. We were talking earlier about low-power amplifiers, and I suspect that is partly where that name comes from.
Well, there's a couple of things going on. First Watt is my little kitchen table company. It started, literally was Kitchen Table Company, but at this late date, it's expanded to take up all of the old shop space that used to hold Past Labs, which I started here at my house, but which some years ago I moved up into town into a real building. First Watt is an opportunity for me to not only kind of marry the DIY stuff to anything that I might want to be working on at any given time, but it also gives me a playground in which to do what I want without creating trouble for Past Lab, which is the operation that pays the rent. Mm. And so what I have done is I have put kind of an artificial barrier between the two, which is the wattage of the amplifiers themselves are low wattage necessarily, and that puts puts a differentiation between Past Labs products and what we do. They start at 25 watts. I pretty much end at 25 watts. That said, 25 watts for me, for most of what I do, is plenty. And the name First Watt comes from a famous saying by Dick Ulsher, who's one of my favorite audio critics. And his statement was, there are a couple ways of putting it. The first watt is the most important watt. And the other way it's been put is, who cares what an amplifier sounds like at 1,000 watts if it sounds like crap at 1 watt?
Yeah, right.
The emphasis, though, is really what is the sound at those low levels? A lot of commercial products that you see, amplifiers that have enjoyed some kind of success, when you look at the specs on them, there's an emphasis on the distortion at high power levels. It's 0.01% at 1,000 watts. Many of these amplifiers, and there's this has changed over the years, but if we go back a little bit, many and most of the amplifiers in the early days had decent specs at high wattage levels, but you found that the performance declined as the level went down. The distortion went up at lower levels and did so in almost a straight line.
That seems counterintuitive to me. I would think that if the amp is working very hard at the upper end of its capability, it would exhibit more distortion than if it were coasting along, just producing a watt or two.
Well, you'd think, but these were amps that were designed for high power, and so the emphasis is there. And the other end of it is that these were Class B and Class AB amplifiers, where you, again, had the two halves of an output stage playing relay races, and the nonlinear area where the batons are being traded off is down at the low levels.
That's true.
The failure of these things to be as linear at low levels was a function of that, of what's known as crossover distortion. And Class A fixes that very nicely, but a 400 watt per channel Class A amplifier is a wonder to behold. So And a lot of it was market driven. You know, the advertising, the promotion, the demand on the part of consumers was high watts, high distortion. I'm sorry, high watts at low distortion.
At low distortion, yeah.
And it wasn't that much focus on the quality at the lower levels. The whole enterprise has become more sophisticated and matured to the point where a lot of these things are well understood. There are a lot of high quality amplifiers, AB amplifiers, that still are doing quite well at the lower levels. First Watt is simply a company that places the emphasis on the lower levels, and if you want lots of power, you simply go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Now,
Past Labs, for example.
but what the low wattage buys us is the ability to build very simple amplifiers, very linear amplifiers, and even though they are not highly efficient amplifiers, they're not going to dissipate tremendous amounts of energy and be particularly unecological. There's a lot of advantage to operating in the small domain if the consumer has systems that are has a loudspeaker system that's relatively efficient. He can get what he wants on just a few watts, and without a lot of money, he can get a very fine amplifier.
Yeah. Now, I've been getting some questions in the chat room about your semiconductor devices that you're using in some of these amps, and it was something I was going to ask you about anyway. Particularly the SIT, S-I-T, and F-Loop in the chat room says that amplifier designers often are often stuck with components created and produced for other industries and for whom linearity is a secondary design consideration. Can you discuss this and maybe apply it to what you're doing with your with the new SIT transistor, which is some sort of super JFET, if I'm not mistaken?
It's a variety of JFET, but I should probably
JFET stands for
junction
field effect transistor.
Correct. Background on this, of course, in the old days there were just simply tubes, and there were different tubes available for different applications, and occasionally, even tubes were designed with audio in mind. But for the most part, the industry doesn't design with audio in mind because audio is a very small percentage of their sales applications. There are exceptions to that, but pretty much that's the case. So most designers take what they can get and make the best of it, and that's often been the case. After tubes, we had bipolar transistors, which have increased in quality over the years. They started out being fairly crappy, but like I say, nowadays you can get some very fine bipolar devices. In the late 60s, JFETs had the quantum mechanics had come along far enough to be able to realize a JFET, which is a field effect transistor. Looks like a tube in many ways. Most specifically,
looks like or performs like?
It has a character. Of course, it performs like. The characteristic curves of a device like that, and I'm sure you're going to show the curve of the SIT at some point or other, but there's a plot of performance of the various voltages and currents for all these devices, and they fall into families. Well, there we go. That's an SIT, which I'll come to. But you look at the graph, and you've got a vertical of amperage, you've got a horizontal of voltage, and then you step the control input voltages, and you get a family of lines, and then that's the characteristic set of curves. Triodes look like that. Pentodes.
Triodes are a type of tube or transistor that behave in a triode-like manner, right?
They are in fact a tube. And pentodes is the other variety of tube, which have a different characteristic. And but the point here is that all these game devices have a family of curves. They're all kind of different, and some are more desirable for some applications than others. But the JFET was developed as a practical part in the late 60s, but it was always pretty low power, very high quality, kind of tube-like, pentode-tube-like, but low power, low voltage, and used usually for input stages and such. I began working with MOSFETs, which were metal oxide semiconductor field effect transistors, which were kind of like JFETs, but they were a little different. However, the industry managed to produce those as high voltage, high current, high power devices. And so around about the late 80s, I pretty much switched my flag from bipolar transistors to MOSFETs. And part of that was that they, in many ways, are simpler to work with. You can build simpler circuits that function well. They perform well with high bias, Class A conditions. And they're a little more tube-like. They also look like pentodes. And I have been working with JFETs and MOSFETs since. But power JFETs, which are really, in many ways, the most ideal sort of part, up until recently had really not been available as power parts. In the mid-70s, Yamaha and Sony in Japan had developed actual examples of power JFETs, called VFETs is what they were called. V as in actually meant V for vertical structure.
Vertical.
Unfortunately, okay. Unfortunately, it gets confusing quickly because, for instance, almost all the MOSFETs that I play with are vertical structure also, and so VFET is no longer really used. It's become a misnomer because of that. But the Sony and the Yamaha parts were relatively short-lived. Fundamentally, the market wasn't ready for them, is what I think. And so MOSFETs came to dominate, and I've been working with them, as I say, since the late 80s, and when I started Pass Labs and had opportunity to be really clean sheet about my designs, I moved straight over to MOSFETs exclusively for power transistors and pretty much JFETs for lower power transistors, and I just find them to be the devices which sound the best. Mm-hmm. But they also allow me to build very simple circuits that perform well. Excuse me. JFETs... go ahead.
I was going to say, how does that get us to SITs?
Ah, well, power JFETs still became one of those things were very attractive, but they didn't exist. a few years ago, though, and this is one of the reasons I love DIY, is that I get a lot of information back from everybody as well as imparting it to them. And so it's really a two-way street. One of the DIYers informed me that, in fact, he had located some power JFETs made by an outfit called LevelTech. And, of course, I buzzed straight over to their site, found out what the story was, and bought what ended up being half of the world's supply. Yeah. And developed an amplifier for it that was extremely tube-like. It was the first Watt F3, a little 15-watt amplifier, single-ended Class A. And a really rather marvelous amplifier. And that whetted my taste, as you can imagine, for power JFETs. But unfortunately, these particular ones were quite low voltage, quite low power, and so they needed to be put in rather special circuits in order to get the performance out of them. What I was looking for ultimately is power JFETs where they are high voltage, high power, high current, just like the MOSFETs that I already had. And another DIYer subsequently, about 2 years ago, clued me into a company called SemiSouth, which it turns out are making power JFETs out of silicon carbide, which is a new material that can be operated at very much higher temperatures. It has different electronic characteristics than silicon. And I contacted them and began playing with some of the parts that they already had. And these are power JFETs, junction FETs. When I use them in amplifiers, I get lower distortion. Very straightforward proposition. They work mm-hmm. a lot like MOSFETs in many of the ways that are important, and that's convenient because you can drop them into different types of simple designs. But when you looked at their characteristic, the bandwidth was better, the distortion was lower, and the price was about 20 times higher. That's not a problem. I don't mind spending 20 times higher in a transistor. Usually transistors themselves are a lower part of the actual cost of a product. This is an industry in which people will spend, you know, anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000 on their hi-fi. So $50 for a part, for a transistor, which can make a tremendous amount of difference in the context of all that, is not exorbitantly expensive. Tubes cost that much.
So
I've been playing with these JFETs. I came out with another amplifier called the J2, which used these power JFETs, which I'm still selling and have been very successful, particularly in Asia, where I think that there's a strong appreciation of these sorts of things. Very, very simple, high-performance circuit. And I was having a nice conversation with head of engineering development at SemiSouth one day, and he goes, you know, we had a contract once upon a time I think this was one of those government contracts, for some static induction transistors. And it had been noted at the time, one of our guys remarked that these would be ideal audio transistors. And, you know, we thought maybe you could be interested in that. We don't have any samples, but we know how to make them. And apparently they had done a run of parts for what appears to be a military contractor some years ago who showed up, scooped up all the dye and went away. These are radar parts. And it turns out also that our government isn't the only outfit that has developed some kind of an interest in this stuff. The Russians have also been developing these kinds of parts and putting them in radar, and the Japanese also had made some. These actually had originated in Japan, and they're called static induction transistors. They are JFETs, but they have a particular structure to them so that instead of looking like a pentode in that characteristic curve, they look like a triode. But that wasn't the goal with regards to the design for why these things were developed for radar. It had a lot more to do with the tremendous bandwidth that they could manage, and especially when fabricated out of silicon carbide, they also have tremendous dissipation capabilities. And so That's a great interest to the military, as you can imagine. All of these JFETs were by SemiSouth had been developed for high power switching, radar usage, solar cells, electric cars, where absolute in the case of the energy case, the energy industry, extracting that last ounce of efficiency out of the switcher that has to convert, say, solar cell power to something that you want to use. Every little percentage point means a lot over the life of a product. It's worth a lot of money to have something that does that even a tiny bit more efficiently. And these are all parts, none of them developed with audio in mind, but which happen to function very well as a coincidence for audio purposes. And in that regard, well, it was a byproduct. But it really comes down to low distortion intrinsically.
So are we going to see some products from First Watt that use these SITs?
Well, I'll finish the story.
Sorry.
So they gave me they made me an offer to finance development and production of a single run of these devices, but they were scaled down from radar usage, which is extremely high voltage, much lower current, and so on, to the kinds of voltages and currents and impedances that would be of interest to a loudspeaker. And in this particular case, the devices intrinsically act as if they want to be looking at a load between 4 and about 16 ohms. And the characteristic is virtually ideal in that regard. And so that was about a year ago, and it cost a fortune. It was a bit of a gamble, but I ended up with some boxes of parts, and they are in fact appear to be all that has been promised. And right now we're in the process of putting them into prototype circuits, evaluating the objective performance, and then sitting down and spending actual time listening to them under various conditions to see what it is we really have, because listening is the end result, or the last test, maybe even the first test that we involved in. And
sure.
Objective measurement is used to inform our subjective conclusions.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and I'm really sorry about that, because there's a lot more we could be talking about.
I can go on for a very long time. It's true.
Yeah, exactly. Well, will you come back and be a guest again sometime?
I think we'll probably do that. Yes, I'd like to.
Excellent. Wonderful. Thank you. Nelson Pass of Pass Labs and First Watt for a wonderful conversation. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Good, good. You can find out more about Nelson's work at passlabs.com or firstwatt.com. And he mentioned also his website, DIYaudio.com, where you can find out a lot of stuff about building your own electronics, amplifiers in particular. and PassDIY.com. My online homes are UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at HTGeekScott. Next week's episode will be a little different than usual. I'll be talking with my colleague Tom Norton about basic setup tips for your home theater. So get your questions ready. We're going to be taking a lot of questions and also talking about how to set up your display and your speakers and your receiver and so on. So I think it's going to be a very valuable hour that I sure hope you will tune in for. Until then, geek out!